I'm Ellen Mary.
And I'm Michael Perry.
And he's a plant geek.
And she's a plant addict.
And this is the Plant-Based Podcast.
This is more than just a gardening podcast. We'll be exploring the world of plants from every possible angle. We'll be talking about plant-based diets, plant materials and fabrics, the well-being qualities of plants, and giving plenty of gardening tips and tricks.
So we'll be chatting worldwide to companies and individuals that are being creative with plants in new and exciting ways, from fabulous flower crowns to foliage-filled lounges,
botanical moisturizers to bamboo clothing.
It's all here.
And it's all made of plants.
Sutton's, suppliers of gardening products since 1806, sponsor the Plant-Based Podcast. Visit them online at suttons.co.uk.
So, Michael, we're here this morning. What a beautiful, beautiful day it is. Just tell us a bit about the history of the garden.
So, Chelsea Physic Garden is quite an old garden. It was founded in 1673 by the Worshipful Society of Apothecaries, and they chose this small 3-acre or thereabout site on the banks of the Thames to grow medicinal plants, learn how to use them, learn how to identify them, and which part to use, how to prepare them and make them into medicines as well. Nowadays we've got a learning program which looks at schools and families. We have outreach, we have adult groups, and we're open to the public, so it's quite a popular place, lovely cafe, and the garden. So about 5,000 species of plants from around the world.
Was there a particular reason for being located here?
I think it was mostly, I mean, they'd been displaced after the Great Fire of London, which I guess if you're involved with wasn't that great at all. And they needed a new place to set up, and they went to sort of out of London, which this Chelsea would have been a little village on the outskirts of London. And because it was already cultivated, because it had riverside access, it was already cultivated land for market gardens, it was perfect for them. It suited their purposes. And they could store their boats here, and they could also charge rent from other livery companies who wanted boat parking space, as it were, mooring space on the site.
You go to a garden and the history behind it is what, you know, it's what makes it. It's the whole personality behind it.
Definitely. And so then soon plants were arriving from all around the world then, I guess.
Yeah.
This easy route down the Thames.
Precisely. I mean, some of them would have been things that they probably had their own seeds of already. Some of them would have been things that they could have just got from further downstream or upstream, just on little field trips, which they did as part of their studies. And then, much further afield, like South America and other parts of Europe, and through seed exchange and letter writing, and also quite major voyages, some of them quite famous ones.
Right.
Okay, and in this podcast we're going to major mostly on medicinal plants, and there's obviously a lot of key medicinal plants that have been brought to the garden and are still here and have been used in the creation of a lot of drugs as well. Specific examples do you have?
I think one of the earliest ones that we got records of is the plant that gives us the anti-malarial drug quinine, the substance quinine, the cinchona plant from South America. And there are records of us not only having glasshouses, heated glasshouses, but also having this plant in our collection as early as 1685.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I suppose it is still used, although other plants are used to treat malaria nowadays. It is still used, as well as flavouring tonic water as well, but I suppose that's one of the examples of sort of one of the oldest ones, I suppose. And now we have quite a large medicinal collection which is subdivided by culture and geography, as well as into the different ologies and different parts of the body that it relates to and the medicines relate to. So we have quite a range of quite rare things and quite kind of over-the-counter common things too.
I bet people learn a lot when they come here and they realise how lot of drugs are put together, pretty
indeed,
much.
Indeed.
The signage is so good. You know, when you walk around the beds and you can see it. And also the plants are full of vitamins and, you know, I love that. It's very, very
good. Yeah, having the garden of edible plants in the last, since 2012, it's been really good because obviously everyone's interested in nutrition, and certainly from my point of view, it's important for the school's curriculum as well. So having a vitamin A, B, C, and E and K there is brilliant. And then we've also got, not built around the same time, not far from where the vitamin beds are, is a garden of useful plants, which is showing some of the other things. So things that we might build a house with, things that you might make into a musical instrument, things that give us perfumes and other cosmetics, and things that feature in different world religions.
That's
and
so interesting. So I'd love to come back to that. I'll come back to that later, definitely.
I mean, it's ethnobotany. It's a gigantic subject.
Yeah, I'm sure. And, you know, you've got a massive knowledge base here, which is more than apparent. And I know you've been here a long time, not quite as long as the garden.
25 years. It's almost 25 years working here.
How did you become involved in the garden then in the first place?
I originally came here as a volunteer in the mid-1990s and just showed interest in learning about plants. I had a great appetite, as I do now, for just finding out more about how plants could be used in our lives and how they are absolutely essential, not just medicines, but all those other things too. And I just showed willingness and interest enough for someone to find some funding for a bit of a mini salary, and then went from a few days a week to full time, and here I am now.
So a maxi salary. We hope. Were you similar to us then? You were a plant geek right back when you were a kid, like 4 or 5 years old.
My parents, when I was about 8 years old, I think it's like my 8th birthday present. My mum and dad bought me a book by Keith Mossman called the Pip Book, which helps you just grow stuff that you'd otherwise throw away. So lemon pips and orange pips. Wow. Brilliant book. I think it's out of print now, but it's really, really good. And that got me really switched on. But they're also vegetable gardeners. You know, they had their own little, quite a large amount of berries and fruits and vegetables at home. So that was, you know, it was in my consciousness. Anyway.
I think for all of it, it's in the blood, isn't it?
I think so.
You're going to be into gardening and plants, or not? Don't you? Definitely.
And also, it was a lovely story that you were a volunteer first as well. You know, that shows how important it is to get involved in gardens and go and volunteer and learn as you go along.
And you're now doing a lot with the education here, aren't you?
Absolutely. I mean, as head of education here, I oversee a program of quite a lot of schools, maybe about 100 schools visiting us per year, most of them primary, some of them are secondary schools, and they're looking at various aspects of the curriculum. It could be about health, it could be about well-being, it might be about habitats, food chains, food webs, and then plants and their life cycles and seed dispersal and pollination, all that kind of thing. This is quite a rich habitat. We've got a pigeon walking around us right now.
He kept sitting on the table earlier on.
I'm hoping we've got cakes, which we haven't got. But this is. I would also, because of my original kind of training at university was ecology, and I see this as a sort of a mini nature reserve in the centre of London. And so the pigeons and the ladybirds and the worms and the bees and the butterflies and the fungi and the lichens, it's their home, and it's quite a rich tapestry here, really. And our pond doesn't have fish, so it's quite a healthy pond, which is a great opportunity then to talk about food chains and interrelationships in the natural world to various groups.
What a beautiful home it is,
and in such a like central location of London. So unexpected to a lot of visitors, isn't it?
Perfect walled garden. So you were saying earlier on, of course, about how plants are currently really big at the moment. We're all thinking a little bit more about our diets and medicine, what we're putting into our body. Have you seen that trend kind of increase recently?
That's a good question. I suppose when we've had talks and some of our supper talks on various subjects on about plants and the use of plants in different ways, not just kind of weird and wacky ones, but also the uses of herbal medicines and how people can use them in their daily lives in a very easy, accessible way. Those have been really, really popular.
Right.
And actually, our our living medicine courses, which we have 5 per year, on different aspects of your different parts of the body for each of the courses, those have been oversubscribed. So, sort of fully booked each time. So that tells me that, there's definite interest in people wanting to be able to enable themselves to learn skills to put to practice in their daily lives, in their diets.
I think it's really empowering, actually, to think about what, you know, not just what you're putting into your body, but growing it yourself, learning how to use it, you know, what to do with it, how it's good for you specifically, and then actually making or using it in the way that you do. Even if it's teas or tinctures or creams or any of those kind of things, it's quite an empowering process to understand.
Taking full control of your health.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the fact you can grow it as well, and then tapping into the growing trend. So, yeah, what could be better?
Yeah. And also, I mean, many common drugs are plant-based, but we don't know it, do we? We're taking whatever we're taking, but actually, the goodness in that, what you need, is just the plant. We don't need all the rest of the chemicals, perhaps.
Precisely. Well, quite a lot of the main, largest sort of pharmaceutical drugs in the world, I suppose, are either directly taken from a plant, such as morphine is a good example, because for the maybe 4,000 years that has been used and as a painkiller, but taken directly from the plant. It's complicated alkaloid that can't be synthesized very easily, so it's the plant is still the source. With a lot of other ones, if they can be replicated in a laboratory, it's probably easier for a pharmaceutical company to do so, because then they don't have to have a farm to grow them. But so many of these are such complicated chemicals that it's just getting it from a plant is by far the easiest, and then maybe tweaking it or taking a bit of, you know, tweaking the molecule once you've harvested it from the plant. But yeah, absolutely,
that's great. And what do you feel the future really is for medicinal plants then? Before we go on and look at what people can use at home, how do you feel like medicinal plants will be used in the drug industry going forward now? So, because times are changing.
So I mean, in terms of the pharmaceutical, because you could look at medicines in different ways. You mentioned foods and medicines. There's a sort of the Venn diagram of food, medicine and poisons, and there are some where the food crosses over with medicine, which is the sort of the everyday and what most people can do for themselves. Then you've got the where the medicine crosses over with the overlap in the Venn diagram with poisons. That's, I suppose, more into the sort of the pharmaceutical side. This is the always read the label and, you know, take only as directed by your doctor, etc. Because if you take too much of the dose, that's when you poison yourself. So what's the future of those? Well, that's a huge question, and I'm not totally sure I'm qualified to answer it, but I would think that, I suppose, as time goes on, pharmaceutical companies get better and better at refining and ironing out side effects, because with all sorts of drugs, there are always side effects, and that's because you're taking a dose of poison. And maybe in the future there'll be fewer side effects. Some would argue, some of our colleagues over at the Royal College of Physicians have mentioned that maybe there isn't a future for plant-based medicines. Maybe the future of medicine is genetic medicine, where, like, you can switch on and switch off a light switch with a switch, is you can maybe genetically switch on an antibody or switch off a disease or something like that. So maybe that's the future of medicine.
And that's really fascinating. And I get on my high horse a little bit about pharmaceuticals and I don't know, it's all about money and all of that kind of thing. But ultimately, the end goal is to make us feel better or to cure diseases and viruses. So that's understandable. And the thought that maybe that's progressing in positive ways is fantastic. But I think that if we can help ourselves sometimes, you know, just for the common illnesses.
Well, that's purely by what we eat sometimes. You know, lead a healthier lifestyle,
Exactly.
eat a better diet.
And then ultimately you may not need the pharmaceuticals.
Exactly,
because you've kind of helped to look after yourself.
The preventative medicine. That's the bit where the food crosses over with the medicine, I would say. So, for example, you know, we put things like spices in our food to make our food more interesting. So it's, you know, ginger and turmeric and cumin and chilies. It makes our food, and black pepper, a really good one, and garlic makes our food a bit more funky. But actually, those are doses of medicine. They keep us well. If I start getting a bit of a cold, I make my mother-in-law's recipe of a South Indian spicy soup called rasam, which is tamarind and tomato and chili and black pepper and other
it sounds
spices.
Delicious.
And it's hot, it's sour, it's sweet.
Lovely.
It's kind of, I think it, you know, goes to war with whatever's trying to incubate in me. Yeah. And it does the trick.
So tasty food can also mean ultra good for you.
Absolutely.
So we'll talk a little bit more about what people can do at home.
Absolutely. Well, look at how you can grow your own drugs, in inverted commas.
Yeah.
It's really interesting to hear the history of Chelsea Physic Garden, isn't it? Because sometimes, you know, you go to visit a garden but don't necessarily know how it started, or all of those incredibly rare and unusual plants and how they were brought in along the Thames.
I know, such a key location for that. And I've always enjoyed coming to Chelsea Physic Garden. I learn something every time. And every time I'm here, there's another corner that I find I haven't discovered.
Yeah.
And it's great. There's so much signage as well, and you can really learn about where these plants come from, and in some cases find some of those plants that you can use at home in a safe way to solve a lot of medical problems that we have.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, what have you used some plants at home to alleviate colds and
I use plants a lot at home, and mainly herbs, I guess. I mean, I've used Angelica, fennel, lavender frequently, because my mind is always racing and I need to snooze off quickly. So lavender is really, really good for that.
I often use lavender oil on my pillow.
Yeah.
But conversely, I often use peppermint oil on the temples of my forehead in order to make myself more alert.
Do you?
The opposite of lavender.
You need to be more alert. Oh my goodness.
You don't.
Lavender oil rubbed in your temples is good for headaches. I've had dandelion root tea as well for headaches, which is very good. So yeah, I do try and incorporate that a lot in my daily life.
That's great. I think, you know, different cultures have a different kind of respect for plants as well. You know, Chinese medicine uses a lot of plants.
Yeah.
Also, my partner's from Poland, and I had a really bad, I had kind of like a headache. I was feeling a bit flu-y the other week. And he fed me up with a cheese and garlic sandwich.
Right.
Fresh garlic sliced in this sandwich, as if it was a cheese and onion sandwich. But cheese and garlic. But, you know, he was aware of the health-giving properties of garlic. And, you know, just today I've had a ginger shot as well, you know, from the kind of like high street sandwich shop, and they're becoming more aware of selling those little shots as
well. Very much. And interestingly, the use of medicine in daily life, or herbal medicine in daily life, because you were just mentioning the Chinese medicine, did you know that it was actually only very recent that the that Chinese medicine was recognised in China and prescribed?
Okay.
Only recently, yet we all go to herbal.
Yeah, I didn't realise that. I spent a lot of time in China and have great respect for these stores, and they, you know, full of all these random looking pieces of root and leaves.
Yeah.
And,
but it's actually only just recently been prescribed. Isn't that interesting?
It's definitely taking its time to be prescribed here, isn't it?
Oh, it is. Yeah. It very much is. So hopefully we'll have more than that. But coming up, we speak to Michael, don't we?
About, we do.
What we can do at home.
Yes, some great recipes coming up. So we found out lots about Chelsea Physic Garden so far, in terms of its location, the plants that are there, and how medicine plays a role in our day-to-day lives and how that could change. But now we're going to look at some drugs that you can grow yourself at home and how to administer those in a safe and sensible way. So what can listeners do at home in order to grow some of their own kind of small remedies for maybe common colds, coughs? What options do people have, and what do they need to consider? Are there any risks?
Yes, there are risks, definitely. I mean, arguably anything in the world could be poisonous in a large quantity. Some things that we grow here, such as yew trees and foxgloves, are poisonous in a very small dose. So what I'd suggest in terms of doing things at home is go for the food end of the spectrum. Go away from the pharmaceutical side and focus on a few simple, tried and tested remedies. I would say, for example, let's get completely gross here. Phlegmy, chesty coughs. not a Russian.
We didn't need an example.
But the kind of stuff when you've got that stuff that's not coming up, and it's coming up but it's not coming out, and you've got it, got to get it out, and it's causing you breathing difficulties.
Yeah.
That is relieved very, very easily by a wonderful and very easy to make onion syrup.
Okay.
So you take a jar, empty jam jar, or a drinking glass if you want to, and you just put layers of sugar, raw onion, sugar, raw onion, sugar, raw onion, and end with sugar. Put a lid on it, definitely put a lid on it, or kind of some sort of film over the top, or preferably a tight-fitting lid. Leave it in a room temperature for 2 days. all those fumes coming off your onion that would normally go into your eyes and make you cry when you're cutting them, bounce around inside the jar, melt the sugar, and it turns into this rather lovely onion, but not hot, not disgusting tasting syrup, which you can take a teaspoon of a couple of times a day, and it just shifts that.
That's great. So that's simple.
That's a really good go-to straight away, and it costs pennies to make, basically.
I've never heard of that before. Yeah. That's a great tip.
Another one would be a kind of goes well with onions as a stuffing is sage. Mm-hmm. So sage is just salvia officinalis, is common sage for cooking. Obviously, it's useful in Mediterranean cookery, but a simple one, but you must be careful if you're a pregnant or nursing mother, avoid sage and avoid certain types of mint because they can have a very adverse effect if you're pregnant. But with sage, something like if you've got a sore throat, you can make a really nice sore throat gargle just by covering a handful of sage leaves with boiling water, wait till it cools, and then take away the leaves and just add a couple of teaspoons or tablespoons rather of apple cider vinegar. And then you have a gargle. Maybe add a little bit of salt as well if you want to. And then you have a gargle which can be used to alleviate sore throats.
Sage is my least favourite.
Really? You don't like the smell?
The smell is just... some are worse than others, I think. But yeah, it really it puts me off. But I have it and I cook with it, but it's my least favourite. Somebody who I know swears by taking echinacea for colds to prevent them.
But that's... How would you... that's the tablet. How would you use the echinacea plant? Is there any way you could process it yourself?
You could make your own tincture, I suppose. I mean,
because that involves vodka, right?
It could be. It could be vodka.
So
it could
explain to us what explain to listeners what a tincture is.
A tincture is basically a liquid extract of a plant. So basically by putting the plant material, whether it's... rosemary leaves or sage leaves or echinacea root into alcohol such as vodka for a set number of days or weeks and probably shaking it every day or so, and then you strain that out and mix it with a certain amount of water to make it into a sort of dilute it, then you just take a pipette of it a couple of times a day.
So you really can make your own medicinal remedies.
Yeah, absolutely. Calendula is fantastic, isn't it, for all kinds of different things.
Calendula is a really good one, the pot marigold. Yeah, it's that's usually used for the skin. We we have a recipe here, and in fact, this Friday we've got a school group coming to do a lotions and potions workshop. And we had one last week.
We want to come.
Yeah, school, I do want to come.
School half term, doing the same sort of thing. One of the remedies we make quite a lot of. This isn't one to take internally at all, but it's a really good one for the skin. Is an ointment, quite a simple to make ointment using. You can either use calendula flowers, or you could use. We've done it with a combination of calendula flowers, as well as comfrey. Comfrey is in the same family as forget-me-nots and echiums and borage, and it's that's quite good. It's also it's sort of herbal remedy. Historically, nickname is nip bone because it's famed for being able to literally soak through the skin above a broken bone and knit the bone together.
Really?
When it's applied to the external. But as an ointment, it's quite a nice one to make. We've made that. It's quite an earthy smell, so we've mixed that with lavender essential oil and then with calendula as well.
A couple of years ago, I had a running injury and I really hurt my knee and it was really very swollen and I'd done everything that you're told to do, rest it, ice it, all of those things. And weeks later, it wasn't getting any better. And I bought some comfrey ointment.
Yes.
I didn't make it myself. I use it more to feed my plants.
Yeah.
And I absolutely 100% tell you that that was the only thing that helped.
Yeah.
It's, genuinely.
It's an amazing plant. And the thing about the comfrey plant, which is Symphytum, is its genus name. Is it's great for wildlife. Bees love it. It's good for us because it can be used on the skin and as a healer, and it's great for gardeners, you mentioned. Yeah.
Well, you can soak it to make a fertiliser, can't you?
Yeah. Pokey stuff.
Yeah.
It stinks,
it
really.
Smells.
Like unflushed toilet, but it's really good. It can be mixed with nettles into a liquinure.
So that's the medicine for your plants.
Precisely. So I see it as an all-round healer. It's quite an amazing plant, actually.
But I guess people don't grow it because it's not that showy, is it?
I love it.
Yeah. I mean, it's showy to us because we appreciate plants, but to many people, it's just this kind of leafy plant with a very small inconspicuous flower, really, at times.
I'm just going back to what you were saying about some poisonous plants or plants that you know you wouldn't eat, or certainly even a small amount would make you poorly.
Yeah.
You're saying about the yew and foxgloves, both of which you wouldn't just digest, but actually they are used in medicine, aren't
they? That's the kind of the fantastic paradox.
Yeah.
The double-edged sword that they can kill you and they can cure you. And I love that. And we've got quite a lot of plants that have got this sort of Jekyll and Hyde side to them here.
Oh, I love that.
And the yew tree is a brilliant one because with 50 leaves, that would be enough to kill an adult or a human. 50 leaves, that's needles, sort of like a Christmas tree, so small leaves, but in a tiny dose, the chemical Taxol inside it could cure ovarian or breast cancer.
Yeah,
if used in the right way, the right dose.
I know some gardens, once they've clipped their yew, that's collected for a cancer charity.
Yeah, exactly.
Really?
Yeah, I know a few who've done that in the past. Yeah. And then, of course, foxglove as well, which you definitely wouldn't eat. But that's good for arrhythmia, isn't it?
Yeah, it's used in heart medicine as well. Yeah. So there's a few like that. The deadly nightshade, a triple belladonna, kill or cure as well. But what else? There's lots of other ones. There's the... I mean, even kind of things that we eat is about not just about the dose of the poison, but one part might be poisonous and the other not. So something like asparagus, we obviously eat asparagus stems when they're growing, but if you eat asparagus seeds, they're poisonous. So it's...
Isn't that weird, though?
Or tomato leaves.
Potato leaves.
Potato leaves.
Yeah.
So what is that thing about... when I was a kid, runner beans, they always used to say, don't eat the bean inside when it's ripe. Okay. But obviously you can eat the bean before it ripens.
I don't know.
Or kidney beans,
Yeah. Maybe they just don't taste so nice.
You cook them. I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah, it must be something about the...
I don't know.
Something about the enzymes inside.
You're told a lot of things when you're a kid that are not... Like, it's more to keep you off the garden sometimes,
yeah,
isn't
probably.
It? But I'm not too sure. But I was, when I was a teenager, I was experimenting with making lots of different kind of herbal remedies. And one that I remember making is like a thyme mouthwash, which is almost like an antiseptic for the throat, isn't it? And again, that's just making a tea with the leaves. And I was always trying to mix some sort of concoctions. I even, not necessarily medicinal, but I tried to make dandelion coffee once as well.
Coffee?
When I was grinding down the roots and it was just, I think I had too much grit in it. It was just, it was dirt as well.
It was very good for headaches.
I was always doing these crazy experiments.
True plant geeks in here. So along with all of the plants that you've got here are medicinal, there's other useful plants, aren't there, as well?
Of course, yes. I mean, things that go into fuels, fuels for keeping us warm and cooking, fuels for making a vehicle move, biodiesels, and ethanols and things like that come from things like maize. I mean, not just because something's a biofuel doesn't mean it's a ultimately amazingly ecologically friendly, because actually you know, you start growing maize just for fuel, then what are you replacing, and whose food are you not growing instead, etc. So there's always other sides to a story, but
there's also, we have a pigeon that's joined us. Another plant geek.
We've got no food for you, pigeon. Sorry. But we, I mean, there's the whole world of ethnobotany is huge. So furniture and musical instruments and our clothes, fibres for clothes. You know, these are fibres that are strong for the plant to allow the plant to not snap on a windy day like today. So we can then use those same fibres and weave them together, and they'll make our clothes strong.
I remember you had a fibre garden in the in the summer, and you had the materials actually hanging out by them on washing lines as well. It's so much that we can learn that it all comes back to plants.
Yeah.
Amazing.
It does.
We love plants, basically. So, you said earlier on about a book that you really enjoyed when you were younger. Was it called The Pip, did you say?
The Pip Book.
The Pip Book. Mm. Are there any other book recommendations for listeners to maybe get started with growing their own medicinal plants?
Good question. I mean, there are quite a lot. There's a really nice book that I know you two would appreciate. It's called How to Enjoy Your Weeds, which is basically looking at all
what
these sorts
saying?
Of plants. What I'm saying is that these are plants. What she's saying in the book is like going for all the things that a lot of gardeners would wage war upon.
Yeah.
Things that a lawn enthusiast would have nightmares about, but actually what a herbalist would revere and use in their daily lives, like, I don't know, dandelions and daisies and ground elder and all these things.
Dandelion I love. But if there is any medicinal or use for bindweed, it can get stuffed.
Exactly. Bindweed's not in that book, actually.
If only the double-flowered form grew wild the way the single one does. Mm. It's beautiful, the double one.
Is it very beautiful?
Yeah, lovely.
Not keen on bindweed.
What about online references, though? Because I guess a lot of information online, but how can you be sure that that's the right information?
Good question, yeah. In terms of books, there's a wealth of stuff from herbal medicine books such as things like Neil's Yard Remedies and Mrs. Grieve, which is a famous one. Uh-huh. I recommend Hoffman's Herbals, another book. Mm-hmm. But
I've got that one.
That's rather good.
I bought it here.
But online, there's also Mrs. Grieve, who's a kind of a famous famous herbalist, and a lot of that's been put online as well. There's a very interesting website. It's not just about medicines, but other uses of plants. Called Plants for a Future. There's a book by Ken Fern of that same name, but also the website Plants for a Future is quite a good directory of useful plants. There's the Herb Society, so if you're looking for a medical herbalist or some courses, we run some courses here at Chelsea Physic Garden, but there's the Herb Society is also quite a good resource.
There's all sorts, isn't there?
There is.
I mean, we've got Google, which is great, but obviously with something like this, you just need to be sure that what you're reading is correct.
You must, you must. You don't want, I mean, don't poison yourself. Don't take any risks, you know. Yeah. And I suppose identification is really important. So getting on a plant course where you can go on a foraging tour and go with an expert and learn what is what, because we've got one example just near where we're sitting. It's just on the other side of this mulberry tree, and we grow two plants next to each other. One is and they're both in the same plant family, they're the carrot family, the Apiaceae family. One is sweet Sicily, which is quite nice. It's got an aniseed flavour, it's good in salads, good for your digestion. And one is hemlock. And they look identical at the early part of the spring, in the early part of the year. And if you were to be foraging for it in the springtime, you could get it wrong. You know, you could go into convulsions and paralysis when all you wanted to do is to relieve your flatulence.
irony.
Game over. Then you've got nothing to worry about then, because it's just game over. So you've got to be careful, you know.
So alternatively, you could bring Chelsea Physic Garden to your own house or workplace?
Yeah, we do. We have an outreach programme, and we have got quite a small team at the moment with volunteers and a couple of staff, where we go to science fairs and we go to schools and colleges and take elements of the garden to different places with some of our wonderful plant artifacts and knowledge and stoves and kit for making things. So the weekend just gone, we're just making soap making workshop for families. It was quite messy, but really, really fun. And all sort of plant-based soaps. And yeah, we can come to you, really.
Okay, and people can visit here every day of the week? What are your
Except for Saturday.
Times?
If you're
Except
getting married, Saturday. You can get married here on a Saturday.
You can get married here?
Yeah, we just had our first couple of actual ceremonies quite recently. And we have lots of other events, hirings for the garden in the garden. But we're open every day except for Saturday to anyone who wants to come along. Late nights in the summer on a couple of the nights, weeknights in the evenings, and we have supper talks, and we have tours of the garden and courses on how to propagate and. Mm-hmm.
Basically,
all
it's a very welcoming environment
It's central London, still easy to get to. What would be the nearest tube stop?
Nearest tube is Sloane Square or South Kensington. It's about a 15-minute walk from 20-minute walk from Victoria, or a bus ride.
Okay, so it's better really to come on the train than to drive here.
If you want a really leisurely way of getting here, go old school and catch the boat.
Yeah?
And it'll drop you off at Duggan Pier, and you can pretend you're an apothecary.
Yeah, bringing in seeds to the garden.
And then it's a 5-minute walk.
That's how
we're
getting home today, love.
Yeah. On the boat?
Yeah, on the boat.
I get a bit seasick.
Oh, no.
There's a bar on the boat as well.
Oh, okay, I'm in then. That's fine.
At least you have an excuse for being sick.
And obviously you've got your website and you're on social media as well.
Yeah, we're on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And LinkedIn, I believe. So we're in all those places.
And very findable.
Very findable. Indeed we are.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Michael.
Very, very well.
We're going to stop as the plane comes over right now. Planes and ambulances.
It might be delivering plants.
There we go. It's just dropping off some plants in the garden. It's been really fascinating. I love using herbs and plants in my own medicines and food myself. So I really hope that it's inspired listeners at home as well.
I hope so.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're looking all bossy.
I wasn't looking bossy.
You've got a resting bossy
how
face.
How can you look bossy?
What, believe me, you
resting
do.
Bitch face.
All those promo pictures we had done, you just look bossy in them all. Do you know what I mean? It's just how your face sits. Oh, God. Oh, no, don't look at me all bossy.
But I'm not bossy, so I don't know why. I don't know why it would look like that.
Anyway, I'm going to eat this cookie.
You've made a real mess
of
my desk.
Well, I'm tipping onto the floor, because look, we've got dogs that are eating.
The dogs can eat the crumbs.
See? It's like, I think they're ducks. Do you want some?
No, thank you.
It's peanut butter and chocolate.
No, because I'm vegan.
You can eat peanut butter, can't you?
Yeah, but it's got chocolate.
Oh,
and it might have butter in the cookie.
Uh huh.
See? So I'll just watch you eat it. And
okay, babe.
It looks very, very nice though.
Ha ha.
And in the meantime, while you eat that, we'll talk about engaging new people in the industry, shall we?
Yeah, new people, not young people.
New people.
Because out there, the conversation often gets caught up in we need to introduce new people to gardening. It's just always the same thing. But we just need to introduce different demographics to gardening. But it is happening. People don't realise it's happening.
It is happening. You only have to look on social media to see that it's happening. You know, 1.5 million hashtags for houseplants. Mm. And horticulture is one of my most viewed hashtags on all of my social media platforms, which shows how many people there are out there interested. I always find that we should engage young people into gardening because it's good for them and it's important, and there's so many life skills that young children learn from it. And yes, we of course we need to, you know, interact and entice young people into the industry. But I do always think that there's this whole demographic that gets forgotten, and that's the career changes. So that may be people who, I don't know, maybe I'm guessing at ages here, 25 to 45, or maybe even older than that, who've had a career, but they've loved gardening, or they want to follow a passion, or they want to be more creative, or they've had enough of being in an office and they want to work outside more. And they do choose horticulture as a new career path. And all of that, those skills and all of that knowledge that those guys have, you know, built up over so many years, they can bring them into horticulture, all that knowledge into horticulture. And I think that's fantastic, but we don't do it. We don't talk about that, do we? It's only bring young people into horticulture.
Yeah, exactly.
But what about everybody else?
Also, I'm always interested in bringing in different demographics, and I don't, like with a lot of what I do, like the TV, the lectures and stuff, it's not really geared towards what everyone else is doing. It's about kind of engaging different people, like with the egg and chips plant, for example.
Yeah.
That would be of interest to not just kids, but actually teenagers. People
Absolutely.
Forget about teenagers.
Yeah.
But also just people that have got no interest in plants, suddenly they're hearing about this Frankenstein plant and they're like, and they're in.
That's interesting, isn't it? And it gets people to think. The teenager age bracket is of interest as well, because there are some schools that provide gardening to young children. But then once they get to perhaps high school, so 11, 12, up until if anyone chooses to go to college and study horticulture, there's nothing. Or there's very, very little. But that's a key age to get people interested in gardening and plants. But that doesn't seem to happen. There doesn't really seem to be anything.
It was never seen as trendy. It was always seen as low rate.
You know, so that they kind of also get missed out, which is a real shame. So, you know, how do you have any ideas of how to reach new people into horticulture? Like, you know, I know we use social media such a lot to reach people. I mean, it's just an amazing tool. But I guess not everybody uses it. And if they're not, if it's somebody who's not interested in gardening or plants, they perhaps wouldn't be looking at gardening and plants on social media. So how do you reach those people?
But are we not getting enough people into the industry? Or have we actually got them in there? And we don't realise. Because, you know, you look at Instagram accounts such as Boys With Plants or people growing succulents and Kokedama and stuff. There's people engaged the world over that are not the usual demographic, and people that weren't engaged in it, like, say, 10 years ago.
Yeah, but is that as a hobby? So they're doing that as a hobby rather than as a career? Because I think the stats still show that there's not enough people coming into the industry overall.
Probably because it would then still be seen as low paid, whether it is or not. But then, of course, it is not... Not all the jobs are the same, do you know what I mean? There's low-paid jobs in every industry, for sure.
Of course.
You look at waitressing, etc., etc. But also, there are better-paid jobs in that industry too, and there's jobs that perhaps these people wouldn't imagine exist. You know, like, for example, what we do is very... You couldn't kind of... When you were a kid, you wouldn't sit around and imagine you'd be doing what we're doing now, you know?
No, I mean, it would never have even crossed anybody's mind that it would have even been possible. I think... When you mention horticulture as a career, people assume that that means mowing lawns, which is great and needed. But there's a million other careers out there as well. There's retail and there's science.
Exactly.
You know, and
marketing,
there's
marketing, product development. Yeah,
marketing, the kind of thing that you do. You know, plant hunting around the world. It's just there's so many careers within the industry, and that's, I think, the key to pulling more people in is making everyone more aware of what there is available.
Definitely. Yeah, but I do think it's happening. I think people are interested more than the industry imagines, you know.
Yeah, I agree.
The thing. But I think the industry sometimes can be so clunky about trying to attract those people.
Yeah.
Really.
I think sometimes people don't know how to do it.
A bit too insular sometimes. I don't know, I think that's why... I don't know. It's weird because I guess the same in any industry. It's kind of like, you know, there's a lot of old school stuff that goes on and there's a lot of new blood that isn't necessarily then allowed to have their influence in order to change it. But I don't know if that's rooted in horticulture.
Ding dong.
Or it happens in every industry because, you know, I come across this all the time, kind of people that... You know, look at my age and, you know, I'm not even that young, but they're kind of, because I'm younger than what a gardener looks like, they assume I wouldn't have any knowledge or they wouldn't, like, listen to what I'm trying to influence. But actually, I could help them and open up the mind so much better and help to recruit these people that they feel they need to get into the industry.
You know, Alan Titchmarsh said at the Garden Media Guild Awards, he got up and done a presentation. And he said, yes, he said, we need to encourage more people into the industry. And at that point, I thought, rolled my eyes, because I thought, I've heard this so many times, everyone says it, but nothing ever actually happens. But then he said, so let's let the people who know how to do that do it. And I thought, brilliant. So he did actually, you know, my assumption when he started talking was like, oh, here we go again. We've heard it so many times.
But he sees what's happening.
Yeah, he said, he actually said, you know, I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to use these tools, but other people do, let them do it. And I thought, yes, Alan.
Yeah, that's such a good point. Agree. Yeah, I come across all the time the kind of old school that kind of doesn't really acknowledge or respect what I do. They just see it as silly and frivolous or whatever, but it's like, well, actually, I'm a lot more approachable and doing a lot more for getting people into horticulture than you ever could or ever did.
Yeah, more people in horticulture. We need them.
For sure.
Let's keep going on about it.
banging on.
Rather than just going on about it.
Of course, Ellen. We love to keep banging on about stuff.
You just keep banging on.
The Plant-Based Podcast is sponsored by Sutton's, suppliers of gardeners' favourite products since 1806. Unsurprisingly, Sutton's now have everything you need for your outside space. Award-winning flower and vegetable plants, garden furniture and equipment, plus gifts for gardeners. Visit them online at suttons.co.uk.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Plant-Based Podcast.
Have a browse of the rest of the library or hop on over to the website, which is theplantbasedpodcast.net.
You'll also find our social media links. Please connect with us and let us know about any plant-based projects that you think we should be covering on the show.
And make sure you subscribe to our podcast so you'll be the first to hear the next episode. We're releasing once a fortnight. So until next time, enjoy the world of plants.